Bye. Yas,
yes.
Savatrana Vishnehas, Tatat, Prapya, Suvashubham, Nabhinandati, Nadveshti, Tasya, Pragya, Pratishthita, Yasarvatrana Vishnehas, Tattat Prapya Subhashubham, Nabhinandanti Nadveshti, Tasya Pragya Pratishthita, Yasarvatrana Vishnehas, Tattat Prapya Subhashubham, Nabhinandanti Nadveshti, Tasya Pragya Pratishthita, Yasarvatrana Vishnehas, Tattat Prapya Subhashubham, Nabhinandanti Nadveshti, Tasya Pragya Pratishthita, Yasarvatrana Vishnehas, Tattat Prapya Subhashubham, Nabhinandanti Nadveshti, Tasya Pragya Pratishthita,
Yasavatrana Vishnehas,
Yasavatrana Vishnehas,
Tatya Prapya Subhashubham,
Tatya Prapya Subhashubham,
Nabhinandanti Nadveshti,
Nabhinandanti Nadveshti,
Tasya Pragya Pratishthita,
Tasya Pragya Pratishthita,
Yasavatrana Vishnehas,
Shubhashubham. Nabhinandanti Nadveshti. Tasya Pragya Pratishthita.
Ya Sarvatra Hinasteshas.
Ya Sarvatra Pratishthas.
Purport. There is always some upheaval in the material world, which may be good or evil. One who is not agitated by such material upheavals, who is unaffected by good and evil, is to be understood to be fixed in Krishna consciousness. As long as one is in the material world, there is always the possibility of good and evil, because the world is full of duality. But one who is fixed in Krishna consciousness is not affected by good and evil, because he is concerned with Krishna. Such consciousness in Krishna is one perfect transcendental position, technically called samadhi. Yes. So, here attachment comes after desire. That we have an attraction to something, and then after becoming attracted to it, then we become attached to it. So first we will get attraction, then we will get attachment. So this attachment then is meaning that this is what we want, it's our goal. Right? Because attachment means the thing that you are attached to is very much desired, it's necessary. It's important for us. So that makes it a goal for us. So then, obtaining good or obtaining evil, then one is not disturbed. Because if one has no material attachment, then there is nothing to gain or lose in this world. So therefore, there's no good and evil. Good and evil would also indicate that we are discerning between material results and material activities on, you know, for what will be good for us. Good, what is the meaning of good? Right? The actual transcendental meaning means what is good for Krishna. But otherwise in this material world, good means what gives a good result. And evil means what gives a bad result. So, and this even can come into question, because who sets the standard of what is good and what is bad? Now we can take what the Shastras say are good. You know, good means pious activities, and a good result means that you will become opulent, you know, become educated, beauty, wealth, power, fame, you know, detachment, all these things will come. One can be elevated to the heavenly planets, born in a very good family, you know, very good social position. These would be good. And to get that, then there must be Vedic or pious good activities. But nowadays, those who are not interested in the Vedic standards, and Vedic standards of what's good, sometimes consider these things not good. These are bad. Right? Because it's said, someone in the mode of ignorance thinks irreligion is religion, and actual religion is irreligion. So then they will make another standard, what's good and what's bad. One may end up in some very difficult position. One is very disturbed. One has been up all night at some party, one has been doing all varieties of nonsense, and in the morning when one is completely wiped out, one is very satisfied. Yes, I have obtained great good, right? You have a headache, you have, you know, you're tired, you have so many difficulties, but it is good, because it was such a, it was nice. So, then this way, then basically, you know, 400,000 varieties of what is good and what is evil. So this can keep one very busy. So someone who is without, doesn't make this duality of good and evil, and he was not attached to anything of this world, that person then is firmly fixed in perfect knowledge. We see here, then the word tat is used, tatya prapya. You know, who is not interested in these things. He doesn't, is interested in this, is not interested in that. So when we get this, a word is repeated like this, generally it means there's an emphasis on this. This is a very important thing. So by not being influenced by these things, then this is very, very important, what's good and what's evil. Is what's good, then we rejoice. What's evil, then we are feeling bad, we lament, right? So rejoicing here, well then we've gained it, so we rejoice. So this rejoicing is then motive passion, having obtained what we want. And then this lamentation, then is motive ignorance, because we have lost something. Something has been gained that we didn't want. So basically when we get freed from passion and ignorance, because passion will mean desire for something that we want, and this lamentation, or anything that comes from ignorance, then will be a so free these things, the attachment is fluency. Then we can be situated in perfect knowledge. So perfect knowledge then will mean we're situated properly in the mode of goodness. And even according to what he's describing here, we're actually going beyond this, to the pure goodness. Because here's perfect, here in fixed and perfect knowledge. So knowledge means that it's, you know, we're fixed in the understanding of the Shastra. But perfect knowledge means realized. This is an important aspect. Because knowledge may be gained, but if you cannot apply it or do not use it, then the knowledge has not reached its perfection. You may have the knowledge, but if you don't apply it, then you're not really getting the benefit. So the benefit comes with realization. Then we see activity. When there's realization, then you see a situation like this where someone can act without attachment. One may have knowledge, you know, this is not good, this is not good, that's not good. But because of attachment, then not be applied. Or we know, you know, this is good, this is bad, and we shouldn't get worried about these things in this world. But we are disturbed by them. Then this also is not perfect knowledge. We have the knowledge, we know we shouldn't be disturbed. But then we are disturbed. So then this is not perfect knowledge. So this perfect knowledge then comes when we are Krishna conscious. When we see what is good is according to Krishna, what is bad is what's not good for Krishna. And so then in any case, whether it's good or bad, we're absorbed in Krishna. We're not seeing it otherwise. We're always seeing it in relationship to Krishna. The result is not good, then we feel that we should make, you know, more endeavor, use our intelligence more, try to find a better way to get something done so that Krishna gets a good result. We're without attachment, therefore, then we can always see that it's for Krishna. When there's attachment, we may forget. When there's not attachment, then we can see that it's Krishna's, it's not ours. It means in the Vedic sacrifices, when an offering is made, then a mantra is chanted that this is for Krishna, it is not for me. Idam Krishnaya, Idam Namama. So every offering, then we are reminded that what I am offering to Krishna, it's for Him, it's not for me. So I'm offering it, it's for His pleasure. The results are His pleasure. Everything are His. It's not mine. Otherwise, then attachment comes. So we have the knowledge, but attachment is there. So when we get rid of that attachment, then we can deal with this good and evil in an equipoised fashion. Because of our attachment, this is good and that's bad. Right? What's prosperous for our attachment is considered good, and what's not prosperous for our attachment is considered bad. So if there's no attachment, then what's the meaning of good and bad? then the only meaning is that meaning has nothing to do with this world. So you have the pure form of something, and you have its reflected form. So the pure form of good or pious is what is being done for Krishna. That is real. Then the reflected form means in this material world, what is pious according to the Vedic literature is it gives in this material world a good result. What they will say good. Good meaning opulent, prosperous result. And bad meaning what will give you the opposite of that. But both of these are not considered good if we are in Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness means what is good for Krishna. What is good for Krishna, that is good. And what is not, that's not good. Because these other things are temporary, they change from moment to moment, from day to day. Especially in the Vedic world, then there is a standard, because God has set it, and even after millions of years, the same standard is there. But in the non-Vedic society, the standard can change every moment. From moment to moment, person to person, place to place, situation, there's no standard, nothing, no standard. So you can't establish standards. So we here is, one should, the idea is now our Krishna is taking Arjuna through this karma, and doing it because it's he'll get a good result, then doing it that it will please Krishna. So he's trying to bring him above all material considerations. So this is a delicate point, because we will see Arjuna will be confused. Because if we listen to this, our natural thing is okay, we should become not rejoice when we obtain good, not lament when we obtain bad. Therefore, we don't deal with anything in the material world. We endeavor for nothing. Therefore, we will get no bad result. Right? I won't get a good result because I don't work. I won't get a bad result because I'm also not working. So this is how I solve the problem. But Krishna will tell Arjuna, no, now you fight. And he's going to be bewildered. You've told me all this nice knowledge, how to become detached from this world, and then you're going to tell me to fight. Right? You're going to tell me to do the activities that give results. They give good results, they give bad results. So this is the key. It doesn't matter the good or bad result, it matters that you're doing it for Krishna. Under Krishna's authority, to please Krishna, that's what's wanted. So this is the whole process that's going on here. It's a matter of, it's impious, from the impious vantage point, God is, one will not see God. One can't see God. Because one thinks one is God. When one takes up pious life, means following the law of God, then one accepts God as the ultimate authority, though we are, you know, small controllers and enjoyers. So that's the second step. But the ultimate step is, I am servant, and Krishna, he's the enjoyer. I'm not the enjoyer, I'm not the controller. So one has to go through this. Otherwise the ignorance is so great when one is engaged in improper activities that one can't see Krishna. So the whole idea is to bring to this. So this is the natural stage. The Acharyas give the example, is if you want to point out the moon to somebody, and they don't know what is the moon. So then you say, okay, you see that house over there? And they say, okay. And see, next to that house is a tree. Okay. So you go up the tree, and then on the left of the tree, there's a branch, and it goes way out. And then just above that, you see a round white circle. That's the moon. So we're pointing out the house, we're pointing out the tree, different aspects of the tree, not because we're interested in the tree or the house, we're interested in the moon. But this will get us to the moon. So in the same way is all these activities, the proper activity, they are because through them we can easily point out what is Krishna. Who is Krishna? What does Krishna do? Right? Means if we don't have experience of a mother dealing nicely with child, very affectionate, then it's very difficult for us to appreciate how Mother Yashoda deals with Krishna. Right? and then you can appreciate what goes on here, and then how much more is the affection of Mother Yashoda. So one can see it's so much superior, but at least you have an idea. Otherwise, very difficult. If you've never experienced, you don't know what it is. What does that mean? What is that a motherly affection? So what is Mother Yashoda doing? No idea. Because pious life is a reflection of the spiritual realm. Though it's perverted, because in the spiritual realm, Krishna is the center. And in the perversion, in that reflected, perverted reflection, then we are the center. Right? We're the child, or we're the mother, like this, and we're, that's the main thing, not Krishna. So these things are they bring us to goodness. From goodness, it's easy to see pure goodness. And then it's very easy to get to Krishna. While from passion and ignorance, very, very difficult. Very difficult to go from one extreme to the other. Or if we do go from one extreme to the other, that's not a problem. But then we will stay. Right? We see examples of this. Magrari the hunter. Right? He used to go out and he was a hunter. And so his family tradition, they were hunters. They would go to the forest, they would hunt, they would kill the animals, they would, you know, eat the animals, the skins they would sell, or sometimes they needed, you know, different things for medicine, this, whatever. He would obtain all these things. But being a hunter, okay, that's bad enough. That's a very difficult situation. It's generally the lifestyle for someone of, you know, not pure consciousness, not a good consciousness. But he was even more, in ignorance. He could kill the animals. He would trap them in such a way to only half kill them. And he would get happiness out of seeing them half dead, you know, moving around in a very disturbed condition. So it was such a sinful person. So then this was Narad Muni came and then, you know, discussed this with him. And so then he understood that this was not good. So then he gave this up, and he became pure Vaishnava. And he stayed on that platform. So we do see it's not that one can't go from a very low position to a very high, but he stayed there. We don't hear that he, you know, would come back and forth. One day he'd be very enthusiastic and Krishna conscious, and the next day he'd be, you know, out there fixing his traps again, and then his wife would have to come and say, "Hey, you told Narad Muni you weren't going to do this anymore." Oh, excuse me. No, he just became fixed in consciousness. Also, Valmiki Muni, he was a big dacoit. He used to, you know, hide on the highway, and when innocent, you know, travelers and merchants would come by, he'd jump out from the bushes and steal everything, kill them, this, that. He was very nasty. It was not nice. So then again, Narad Muni came to him. And, you know, Narad Muni came out and held him up on the road. And then he said, you know, "Before we go any farther, can I ask why you're doing this?" He said, "Because I, you know, have to maintain my family. It's my occupation." He says, "But, you know, this occupation is sinful. You know, you're killing people, you're stealing, you're robbing." Like that. He says, "I know, but what can I do? It's my job." And then he says, "But you're doing this for your family. Okay, you're going to so much trouble, risking going to hell for your family. So because you're doing this to benefit your family, is your family grateful for that? Are they willing to share in this responsibility? You are doing sinful activity, so are they willing to share this sin that you are committing, you know, for their benefit?" So then he stopped and thought, "Yeah, I think so." He says, "But why don't you ask?" You know, he says, "I'm a sadhu, I won't go anywhere. I'll be here when you come back." You know, so he trusted him. And then he went, this Dasaratnakar, which was his name, this dacoit. So then he went to his house and he met the family and explained how he's doing all these sinful things for their benefit. And so, you know, naturally then they would be willing to share in the sin, you know, the sinful reactions. So then they said, "Sinful reactions? Forget it. You know, that's your business, you know." It means your duty is to take care of us. How you do it, that's your business. So the sinful reactions wasn't yours, not ours. You know, we're just the beneficiaries of your duties to take care of us. So then he became very disturbed. He went back to Narad Muni and said, "They're not going to take all these things. I'm doing all these sinful things for them, so what to do?" So Narad Muni says, "Okay, what you should do? You should take shelter of the Lord. Because at that time, Lord Ramachandra was present, and so he said, you should take up the chanting of Ram's name. So he sat him down, you know, nicely, and in a meditative position, and then told him, okay, now chant Ram. He could not chant. He was so sinful, he could not say the Lord's name. It would not come out of his mouth. Right? So then Narada Muni thought and said, can you say kill? Like that. He says, yeah, that I can say, no problem. I do that every day, you know. So in Sanskrit, kill is mara. Right? So then he happily sat down and started chanting mara, mara, you know, kill, 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 kill. Mara, 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 mara. So while he became purified, then he was chanting Ram's name. In this way, then he became great sage, Valmiki. Then he was, the whole pastimes of Ramayana were revealed to him. And then he was entrusted with taking care of Sita Devi and raising Ram's children. He wrote the Ramayana. But we see that in both of these cases, they went from the lowest of the low to the top. Also, Jagai Madhai. There, it's said that there was no rule in the scriptures that they didn't break. Each and every one, they meticulously broke. There was nothing that they didn't do like that. And we see in the law books, there's a lot of laws of a lot of things like that. There's 18 categories of law. And they broke each and every one of them. Right? And within each 18 categories, and there's so many subdivisions and all those things. So every sin that could be done, they did it. And not only that, they were willing to do more, right? And Yamaraj and his men who had to write it all down, they were very disturbed because, you know, how much can you write on one guy, you know? So they told Lord Titania, you have to save these guys because we can't write anymore. So then they were saved and they went from sinful to pure. So these are examples that no matter what our position, we can come to this position that is discussed here. Free from attachment, free from interest in good and evil, all these things. But we see that is, in their case, very exceptional. But in our cases, generally we have a tendency to see one day we're fired up, one day not so much. We go back and forth. We don't have that same determination. So then it is better to be situated on the platform of goodness. Because from goodness to go to pure goodness, back to fall to goodness, then go to pure goodness and fall back down to goodness, like this, back and forth, that is not such a disturbance. Because the goodness will still give knowledge. But to fall from pure goodness to passion or ignorance, and that's very difficult. It's no guarantee that it will keep going back and forth. We may get distracted. Therefore, for in the sadhana bhakti, then it's recommended that one follow all the regulative principles of freedom. Because these regulations, and they purify us, they uplift us, they situate us so that we tend to stay away from impious or sinful activities. But that's not our goal. We're not trying to just become nice, pure, pious people. We're trying to become lovers of God, which is beyond that. So that is being brought out here, is that when we go beyond that, because a pious person is attached to good, and he laments if there's evil. Right? So evil means that he performed something sinful. He feels very bad. It may be the opposite. He hasn't got the result. He's just done it. He feels bad. But the devotee goes beyond, where good means what is connected to Krishna, and bad means what means forgetfulness of Krishna. Right? So then, in that stage, then one can attain perfect knowledge. Any questions on this? Yes, ma'am.
You know, Prabhupada said there's nothing good in this material world, everything is bad. And that's we come to the transcendental fact.
Yeah, this is that there's a verse in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam that describes these two definitions of piety. One definition of piety is material piety according to the scriptures. But the real is what is Krishna conscious. That's piety. That's real piety. And anything, any activity of the material world is considered impious. because it's material. It doesn't give any good lasting result. Even you get a nice result, tomorrow it's gone. Right? You have a beautiful flower, it's so beautiful, but today, tomorrow it wilts. So there's no real good, lasting good in this world. Therefore, it's all temporary. But the transcendental, what is connected to Krishna, that is real good. That is, we can say that is actually beautiful. Because Krishna is always beautiful. He gets more beautiful. Anything that's there in the spiritual world is eternal. It's all perfect. So that's real. And this is the reflection. So for the devotee, for the transcendentalist, there is no good and evil in this world. It's all bad. Because any mundane activity for a mundane purpose is considered useless. Because today it's done, tomorrow what's the use? Like Prabhupada gave an example is, you feed somebody. Okay, today his hunger is satisfied and people will praise, yes, you've done some great work. But tomorrow he's hungry again. And the next day he'll be hungry, and the next day for the rest of his life he'll be hungry. So what you did? What great welfare you did? You did one day you fed him. Okay, maybe you feed him for 10 days or 1 year. But then, what about the next 50 years of his life? Right? And even you take care of him his whole life, you feed him. Then what about his clothes? What about his medicine? What about his shelter? So it's all temporary. It doesn't really give any beneficial. Now if you tell this person, you give him knowledge about who he actually is, that he is a transcendental, eternal spirit soul, connected with God, and you give him food that's been sanctified by offering to God, then he can benefit. And the benefit you have given him is actually eternal. Then it's of some use. Because even if tomorrow you're not able to feed him, you don't have any money, what you have fed him, being spiritual, he still has the spiritual benefit. Maybe his stomach is empty, but the soul has been benefited. So then that's the transcendental view. It's a different kind of viewpoint. So many times it would be devotees, you know, wouldn't be able to understand Prabhupada's viewpoint, because he would go beyond what was good and evil of this world, and he would go to what is transcendental. So sometimes something we would think is very good, you know, like somebody is so renounced, you know, Prabhupada would tell the story about the sadhus, when he would come to put money in his hands would just naturally go behind his back. He wouldn't take money, he wouldn't touch money. And people go, oh, such a sadhu, what a first-class sadhu. He won't touch money. But this money is Lakshmi. It's a potency of Krishna. You know, it's the energy of Krishna. And Lakshmi is supposed to be engaged in Krishna's service. Lakshmi goes with Narayana. So then here comes Lakshmi to be engaged in the Lord's service, and you don't take. You're so renounced. So this renunciation, what's the use of this renunciation? Right? The point is if he sticks out his hands and takes the money, he takes the money for himself. So not wanting to take for himself, therefore he's a little better than others, he puts his hands behind his back so that he doesn't take the money and become entangled in sense gratification. The Prabhupada points out the devotee sticks out both hands and takes the money and then gives it to Krishna. Right? So it's not, the money is not for him, it's for Krishna. Whatever is in this world is not for us, it's for Krishna. So seeing like that, that is the real welfare work, that's the real knowledge, that's the real benefit, you know, eternal activities of the real religion, Sanatana Dharma. So that's the thing. If Krishna has touched it, it's useful. If Krishna doesn't touch it, it's not useful. It's basically that simple. So the whole science is how to understand this point and how to make Krishna touch everything. These two things, basically. And how to get us to give up attachment to things that aren't touched to Krishna. We are attracted to them, give them up. There should be something touched to Krishna. So how to touch everything to Krishna? Right? And even that, touching it to Krishna, that's nice, but still, what's valuable about it? Krishna. Right? This microphone. Okay, we're speaking Bhagavad Gita, so it's considered spiritual. But what's the important element of this? It's the Shravanam Kirtan, not the mic. So even though it's spiritualized, it's good, but still, we should not become attracted or attached to that. Otherwise, then we still stay in this world. So we have to go beyond, is that the hearing and chanting is what's important. And if to do that, we use a mic, and that can make it better, nice. It adds. But the essence is the hearing and chanting. And then we can add, you know, the whole world to that hearing and chanting. But if we have the whole world but no hearing and chanting, then actually we have nothing. You know, it's like having an unlimited amount of, you know, mirage. Right? It's nothing. You can't, no substance. You know, it's just like you go down to the Great Lakes, or, you know, or even there, New York or Great Lakes, and you point at the New York skyline reflected in the Hudson River, and then someone says to another person, you can have all this, it's yours. You know, all these buildings and everything that's reflected here in the water, it's all yours, you can have it. Do what you like with it. What's the use? What can you do with it? You know, you can't get any of it, nothing. So that's the thing. You have the whole world, but there's no hearing and chanting and remembering Krishna, no use.
Had the World Trade Tower, then it would be valuable.
Yeah, well, that's a problem. They're missing now, so even the skyline is... Even that's not such a great... We'll have to go to Chicago. There they have a few big buildings left, right?
Sri Prabhupada used to always say that one should know good in order to do good.
Yeah.
It's the devotees.
Yeah. Makes a point that one should know... Prabhupada makes a point one should know good to do good. So knowing good means knowing Krishna. Then you can actually do what's good. So when someone who knows Krishna, then he can do good for everybody in any situation. Yes.
So through our purification that we get, our transcendental purification, chanting and hearing and remembering, shouldn't the goal be to preach Krishna or distribute books or preach? Shouldn't this be our goal in Krishna consciousness at all times?
Means actually it's not a goal. Our goal is to be engaged in serving the Lord under the direction of the acharyas, because that's the eternal position. I mean, sadharma means that which is eternal. It's always there. So that following the order and serving the previous acharyas, that is the eternal. That's what always lasts. So according to the time, place, and circumstance, then we do what is best for that order. So look at one that this trinity by Krishna. Therefore, to please the Lord, we are doing that. So it actually, for us, it's not the goal. So you have a goal, and then you have a process to get that goal. Right? So if the goal is to please the Lord, then you have a process. So each age has its process. So this age, then, is preaching. So for us, our book distribution, our, you know, prasad distribution, our harinams, our festivals, these are actually a part of our sadhana. They're not a goal. They're actually the process that we do. So it goes into a different category, like that. So it makes it very dynamic. Because if it's only just to distribute the book, then distributing the book, we don't remember. The whole point is Krishna, remember Krishna. Through that, some do that, distributing, so preaching, or bringing the tea. The whole thing is to always chant about Krishna, always remember about Krishna, always hear about Krishna, and to do that under the direction of the acharyas. So it's part of our process by which we you know, hear, chant, remember, and please the Lord. Does that make sense?
So our goal is to please the spiritual master. Our mission always, that is our focus, our
prime
initiative.
Yeah. Our goal is that. If we please the spiritual master, yasya prashada, bhagavat prashado, yasya prashadam, nagati padoki. We please the spiritual master, Krishna is pleased. Because the spiritual master knows how to please Krishna. Therefore, we take, for us, as Saraswatas, means we're Rupanugas, that we are pleasing Krishna according to how Rupa Goswami has given direction. So this very much specifies our position, that we are serving the son of Maharaj Nanda in Vrindavan. That's what we're doing. The other serve, have we weigh by the this distribution of this knowledge of Lord Chaitanya and Krishna, then the Saraswata, then they have a very unique way of doing it, and how they can take anything and use it in Krishna's service. And then of Saraswatas, and specifically for ourselves who have been, you know, picked up and saved by Srila Prabhupada, then we are following his direction. So then all those who come after him, they will follow his directions how to do it. This is the meaning of the term founder acharya. Sometimes we take it founder acharya, like there was, you know, founder of New Vrindavan, or founder of the cow protection, you know, was it International Society for Cow Protection, or founder. No, but that's the modern English term meaning of this. But the way Prabhupada used it is it's a translation of the Sanskrit Sanstapakacharya. The founder acharya, there's only one in the line. Just like before, we see in the lines, you have so many. We have four sampradayas. And in them, for this age, then you have Vishnu Swami in one line as founder acharya, Madhvacharya, Nimbarkacharya, and Ramanujacharya. And we see that they set the standards on what is the goal, how to get that goal, you know, what is the whole mentality, everything, all the rituals, the mantras, everything like that. Then all those followed hundreds of years later, thousands of years. Ramanuja was 1200, Nimbarka was 5000 years ago, like that. Nimbarka was at the junction between the Dwapara Yuga and the Kali Yuga. But 5000 years, and they're still following history. What he's given, his songs he's written, his methods, that they still follow today. So this is founder acharya. So Srila Prabhupada is founder acharya. Then, for however long it is, the indication is there, 10,000 years, then Prabhupada's books will be followed. His instructions, his method will be followed. So then those who his followers give that instruction, give that direction. They give the same siksha, like that. Then it becomes very special. So then pleasing the spiritual master, then in this light we can see it means something very specific, that they know what Krishna is wanting. That's why it's very important, the previous acharyas and the founder acharya, because they know. So we follow that. And then knowing that this is what they know, we give that to anybody. That way then, even the newest person can give you perfection. So many devotees came in contact or were made devotees by someone who had maybe become a devotee a few days or a week before them. So what great realization. But they Prabhupada had given them the essence and perfection of the knowledge. That's one thing that struck me when reading about when they started, I think Mukunda went to San Francisco and started preaching there. So up to that time, then we had one temple in New York, you know, with the boss. He was sitting there. And then it was decided to take it to the coast. So Mukunda went.
He actually didn't decide.
Oh, he didn't decide to go.
I'll tell you the rest of the story.
Okay.
No, he was. Had his own idea that he was going to go to India in sitar. He was Ishan.
Uh-huh, okay.
So it was his own idea. Uh-huh. It wasn't Prabhupada's idea.
Uh-huh.
So he was going to go to India and learn sitar. So but he had to get money in San Francisco to go to India.
Uh-huh.
So he left New York, he went to San Francisco. So he had friends there, and the thing is, Prabhupada had made that record, and that record, it was an underground record, it became very popular, of the chanting of Hare Krishna. So when Buddha got to San Francisco, people were chanting from the record. And then they found out that he was a disciple Bhaktivinoda Swami, who made that record. And they were very eager to know more about the chanting and Krishna consciousness and so on. So he found himself in a situation where he was preaching and, you know, it just happened. But he didn't have the intention.
That's funny. Yeah, very interesting. So then we see that when Prabhupada came to San Francisco, and there were so many devotees, one of them means they were followers. You know, they all still had their beards and their hair and their funky outfits. You know, over there, the hippies were called dirty hippies, because they were. The East Coast was more sophisticated and intellectual. The West Coast was more sentimental and kind of funky. That was the... So, but all of them... Each and every one of them would say, I am a servant of Krishna. Krishna is God, I am a servant. The goal is to develop love for Krishna and the process of Krishna. This is for somebody, Kriyoja, and Persian. More as silver than the old. So it's interesting. If you have the essence, then you can give that to someone and it has effect. It has potency. You give he takes out these essence, he gives that to you. And then if you just speak that, because it's been authorized by him and given by him, it will work. That's the important element of the founder acharya. Because then the system is foolproof, right? We're the fools. And the founder acharya has made a system that despite us, it works. Right? So that's what's so special about founder acharyas like that, because Kali Yuga is meant for fools. In the other yugas you don't have founder acharyas, because there it's not needed. People who are interested go out looking, or they may come in contact by causeless mercy, and then they, like we see Magrari and others, they just immediately go from, you know, minus to, you know, 100% in a moment. But in this age, you know, it's basically fools. So there must be a foolproof system. So that system is the founder of charity. Is that okay?
Yes,
sure. Okay. Anything else?
Someone gave him the money, he didn't want to take the money.
Yeah.
But, you know, Papa gave me a good example. You go to the, you know, on the seashore, you know, there's no water on the surface, but you push your hand into the sand, there's water. So then the hard yogi and push, you know, our finger into his heart, you can see deep material desires in his heart.
Yeah, it's true. Because when they put their hand behind their back, then they expect that you're going to react. You're going to say, oh, such a renounced person, such an advanced person. You're going to say that. Now, if nobody notices and says it, you won't see them do it anymore. You know? You'll just see them come, you know, come later, see me in my room, you know, like that. Because they have to get something. So by refusing the money, they'll get more money. There's more respect, they'll get this. And you know, people who are cheap, then you are easily impressed, will be like that. You know, so, huh? Yeah. Just, it's, people do funny things that are different, and they put it, cloak it in so-called spiritualism, and there's always someone who will appreciate it.
Again, it boils down to the same thing. You have to know good in order to do good.
Yes.
That's yes, what their limited knowledge is.
Anything else? Yes.
Is he a founder of Sharia?
Yes. He is the head of the Saraswatis. And of Saraswatis, and we're following Srila Prabhupada.
No, I mean, he did the same, I mean, compared to Srila Prabhupada.
Yes.
Srila Prabhupada is the only founder of the Guru. Or also Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami, he founded the Gaudiya Math.
Yes.
So the Gaudiya Math is, I mean, compared to ISKCON. I want to ask about this. I mean,
it means he's, see, the line is coming like this, Rupanuga, within that Saraswatas, and then within that we ourselves are Prabhupadanugas. So the Gaudiya mission has been established, but within that Gaudiya mission we are following the directions of Srila Prabhupada. Right? That's the point.
But then Srila Prabhupada is Rupanuga.
Huh?
Srila Prabhupada is Rupanuga.
It means all the acharyas are Rupanuga. It means it's all in following Rupa Goswami. See, is there's a bridge. We see up to basically even up to Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj. Then the standard mundane culture in India was Vedic culture. People wanted there to become improved in their mundane life, material life, they would turn to the Vedic culture, the piety of Vedic culture to attain that. But we see with Bhaktivinoda Thakur this started to change with the influence of the English. Like that. So with that, and then that changed there, so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur then directly dealt with this modern world. Before that, the acharyas, the modern world, was the Vedic culture. Narottam Das Thakur was preaching to kings. Srinivas Acharya was initiating kings. Rupanatha, kings were doing... Vindaji was built by Man Singh, who was the commander-in-chief of Akbar's army. So they were moving in the top social rungs of society. They weren't moving less. So, but then that paradigm shifted. So we see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, before taking up the mission, he was a minister to the king of Tripura. He was his astrologer. Right? He would take everything he would do. So then, but he could see that this is not really where the influence and the power lies. The power is lying in this Western culture. That is the influence that's coming in. So seeing that, then he adjusted it so it would completely function within that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur already was setting the mentality, planted the seed and changed the mentality, how to preach to these kind of people. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur turned it into a machine, a preaching machine. And then how to specifically operate that with Westerners, because we see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he established it in India that could be taken to the West, but who was successful in taking it to the West was Srila Prabhupada. So Srila Prabhupada knows how to establish the mission of Saraswati Thakur in the Western world. He knows how to deal with Westerners. He knows what the mentality is, because it's a very delicate thing. When you're dealing with people who don't have an idea of Vedic culture, to introduce Vedic culture to them, it's very delicate. You have to give them the essence, and you cannot let details come in at all very quickly. Because if a detail comes in without its connection to the essence, it's useless. You know? So to go to all the trouble to turn a Westerner and someone that's non-Vedic into a Hindu, what's the use? We've got 1 billion of them here. Why? We no need to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? So you have to do it. So it's very delicate. And we see that others were having difficulty doing this. Others would go to the West. They themselves would become Westernized. The Prabhupada would go to the Westerner, turn them into pure Vaishnavas, who knew the essence. Saragrahi, that's sort of the essence, the highest form of Vaishnavism is Saragrahi, one who knows the essence. Right? So Prabhupada always pointing that out. There are always so many examples where he'd be talking to some great pundit, Sanskrit pundit, you know, runs some big Sanskrit college, knows all the Vedas, and he would ask, what's the essence? Who's God? What is that? Oh, very difficult question to know, this, that, and so many opinions. And then Prabhupada would call over Saraswati, right? Eight-year-old girl, and go, okay, who's God? She'd go, Krishna. He say, she knows, why you don't know? Right? So it's a very delicate thing. It means we take it this and that, but you see, okay, devotees, they follow astrology. Do they connect it to Krishna? Is it connected? Factually. It would be very hard to say yes. They're taking up so many things, Vedic music, Vedic this, Vedic that, but are they connecting it to Krishna? Really? No. In the West, now before, Mayapur, we were doing a yajna for the deities, a Pancharatrik yajna for the deities. For years, everyone would come up and say, this is not Treta Yuga, why you're doing these karmakandis? No, we're doing right out of Bhagavatam. The 11th canto says, in the deity worship, then at this time you do a yajna for the deities using Purusha Shukta. And nobody cared for it. It's all Maya. Until one day someone figured out that Hindus love yajnas, and they'll give any amount of yajnas. Bang! Immediately, any old Joe, whether they're initiated or not, are doing yajnas, and as long as they make money, temple president couldn't care less.
Right.
It's just a way to make money. Like that. You sell stickers, you do a yajna, it doesn't matter. It's one of the things, it works. But is it connected to Krishna? Do they get any spiritual benefit from the yajna? The spiritual benefit is not from the yajna, it's from the money they give that then gets used in Krishna's service. But from the yajna they get no benefit because it's not a spiritual yajna. They're not doing it for spiritual purposes. So therefore then we see so easily that Hinduism just comes in. So this is what Prabhupada was very expert at. And others are not so experienced. So that's why we say specifically then we are following Prabhupada, because he is very expert at dealing with Westerners. He knows how to basically keep them on track. Otherwise so easily we get distracted. As I remember once Prabhupada was talking when Bhakti Trumaraj was going to take sannyas. So he was quite young, very, very simple and pure, from a good family. And then some of the devotees were coming and saying, no, he's so new, this, that, how he can take sannyas, so many things, he's so young, he's so attractive, he may fall down. Prabhupada said, yes, if he falls down, he'll fall down to the mode of goodness. Yes, maybe a drastic fall from, devotional service down to pure goodness, down to goodness, yes. So then, what could they say? So it's a different kind of people. Like that. So that's why you want to say something?
Well, yeah, of course, Prabhupada's mission was, as you say, the Westerners.
Hey, keep the mic, everyone.
And, in his Pranam mantra, it's it was STEM mission, which probably doesn't have anymore. And, I've been reading the conversations, and who sent Prabhupada back to India. And then the Indian mission was. And that Indian mission was in the same mode as the Western mission of Prabhupada going with barely nothing. Instead of $5 or $20 or 30 rupees for the Western mission, Prabhupada went with $5,000. And on the way to India, he stopped in Japan. And he met with Dainirpan. And Prabhupada ordered $50,000. In those days, there's a lot of money. $50,000 worth of books. Krishna book and Bhagavatam, even so on. But he only had $5,000. So he gave that as an advance, which is very little. It's only 10%. Usually you have to give more. But that's all the money Prabhupada had. And they accepted it because they saw. They saw something in Prabhupada. Prabhupada always appreciated their service, the Japanese, Dainirpan. So, with that $5,000, the $50,000 worth of books were sent to India, exclusively. And then when Prabhupada got to India, then he devised this whole life membership program, which was distributing books, which was a little novel way. In the West, the book distribution was done by Sankirtan parties while it was going out, but not in India. In India, it was the life membership program. And of course, through that, eventually, everything was acquired and built up. But Prabhupada revealed that Dwarkadish told Prabhupada that I have taken you out of Vrindavan, and almost by somehow kind of force. I mean, the whole thing was done by force, reluctantly. And Prabhupada didn't want to take sannyasa. I mean, there were so many things along the way. And this was like being impelled. He was impelled to do it. So I've taken you out of Vrindavan. And Prabhupada didn't want to leave Los Angeles because it had just gotten the temple. It was such a nice, big facility. It was a whole new stage of Krishna consciousness in the West, of Los Angeles Temple. You could have temple festivals, 100 devotees could live there. And
that's what's secret.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is 1970. Mm. They only got it like 6 months before. Mm. And maybe a year. So, but Dwarkadish told Prabhupada that I'm sending you back, and you left Vrindavan. I took you out of Vrindavan. Now I'm sending you back to Vrindavan, and you will have a temple 100 times better in Vrindavan than in Los Angeles. And he didn't know how this was going to happen. He had no money, Even in 1970, things were just beginning. I mean, just the Krishna book was the first book with colored pictures. Mm. And that had just come out. So then Prabhupada is here in Vrindavan. He says, so just see, it came so. And this temple is so much better than Los Angeles, Krishna Balaraman here. So that was the extension, then how to engage the Indians. Because another thing I learned, and which I never knew, when Prabhupada left India to come to the West, his intention was to never return to India. And the reason was that he was so disgusted with India, that the things had fallen so low, there was absolutely no scope for spreading Krishna consciousness in India. No one was interested. He couldn't sell his books. Everything was so difficult to even publish the books. And the preaching, no one was interested. It was just one after the other. And what happened in Jhansi, I mean, there's so many things. Prabhupada was totally disgusted. He said, I'm never coming back to India, and no matter what would happen in the West, but he was prepared to, die there, to give his life, whether he was successful or not. He would just be, if there was no response, then he would just be a beggar or whatever, but he would still be trying in the West. So he would go to the shipping company when he was there and inquire when the schedules, when the ships were returning. They would make fun that, Swamiji, you're coming here, you're asking about when the ships are going back, but you're never going. And Prabhupada was doing it actually just as a recreation, just to spend the time. Because he had nothing to do. There was no, in the very early days, there was no response yet. And so he would sometimes just go on the subway, just take rides. He would get on the bus, Fifth Avenue, go up and down Fifth Avenue on the bus. And then he would walk also. Went to the New York Public Library. He would just visit places. So anyway, this is a little background, but the point is that there was the extension of the mission was to then engage the Indians, which he did successfully, although not many Indians joined during the time that Prabhupada was present, but some were coming, presaging the future when many more were coming. Because it was very difficult for the Indians to join, various reasons. The government was so much against our movement, they saying you were CIA and so many things. That was all done from the government side. So, and now we see this Congress party, they're suffering very, very much. All their leaders are all been killed. How can you explain that? All the leaders of the Congress Party were all dead. Even now it's still happening. Why? Because this Congress Party was so much opposed to Prabhupada's movement. Whereas this other party, they were the more religious minded, pious and so on.
They never had that party back then.
It was Janata. It was the forerunners. So that mission of India is all. You can't stress the Western.
Yeah.
Also have to be.
Excuse me. What happened in Jhansi that this time? You said something happened there?
Well, Prabhupada. The question is, what happened in Jhansi? Very interesting. There was a big house and compound and so on. It was vacant. It wasn't being used. And Prabhupada got that house and was occupying it. One man had given it. And he was getting these young medical students were coming, and what happened was that this K.M. Munshi's wife, Bharta Vidya Bhavan, Lilavati Munshi, she saw this house, she wanted to make some woman's mahal kind of thing, samiti, some kind of thing, some kind of welfare program for women, and she wanted that property. And this is very interesting. And so she put a man who gave her games. How about this? He owns the mahal. And who told this man that if you do not give this property to Mrs. Munshi, then when it comes time to renew your license for your cinema hall, you will not get it. He's the one who issued. He said, I will not give. So in that way, he was forced to give over that property, and that Prabhupada had to vacate. And the thing is that Prabhupada had very influential, lawyers in Jhansi, and they told Prabhupada, "Don't leave this place. This is, cannot. We will fight it in the court for you. And you have, you're occupying, and in India, occupying is yeah. So you don't have to leave. You stay." Will fight it and so on. But Prabhupada had a different. He said he could have very easily stayed there and gone on. But he said, I've left my home. Of course, he wasn't sannyasi then, he was vanaprastha, but that's a renounced order. So I've renounced everything, and now I'm going to fight for a house. So he had no taste for that. He had no So he just voluntarily, he just walked away from it. But he had indicated for Krishna that Krishna didn't want him to be his. We said, what? Krishna told Prabhupada, what for you're in Jhansi? To do what? There are other things. And what is the other thing, of course, was the mission by given by Bhaktisiddhanta to go to the West and preach in English. That wasn't going to be done in Jhansi. Although Prabhupada had facility in the Jhansi to do what he wanted to do. He had for training, he could do brahmachari, he could have press, I mean, he had every facility that he wanted. It was such a good facility. But it wasn't the mission. Krishna wanted Prabhupada to go to the West. It came through the spiritual master, through Bhaktisiddhanta. And so that had to be done. So in every area, it was cut and pushed, redirected. And then I read also that Prabhupada, he said, generally, the sadhus, they all go to London. And who knows why? I mean, maybe because it was the British Empire and so on. He said, but Krishna directed Prabhupada to go to New York. It was Krishna's direction to go to New York and not London. So now I was thinking, I was talking with Gargamuna, and we were saying, why did Krishna direct this? And then we realized that in London, you had an Indian population. In New York, there was nothing. London be like the other who's going to become the Indian. No, New York. The laws had just changed. This is another thing, this is a whole other thing of how the immigration laws were changed. The immigration law was restricted to 100 Indians per year. It was called the Asian Exclusion Act.
Is this for the whole country?
Yes. This Asian Exclusion Act was formulated very early in the 20th century, or in the early 1900s. It was specifically, it was a racist act, and it was directed mainly towards, there were many Sikhs in the Northwest, in Washington and Oregon. They were in the lumber industry, and they were taking jobs away from Americans. So they passed this law, and also was directed against the Chinese. You know, they had built the railway, and many had come. So they had this Asian Exclusion Act based on population that were already present in the country. It came out to 100 persons per year could emigrate from India. That Asian Exclusion Act was John F. Kennedy in 1962. Something like 62 or 63. He was killed in 63. He was the first one to make legislation to change that act and open up immigration with no restriction. Of course, he was assassinated. But then Johnson, he continued that. And finally, they had to fight, you know, to get any legislation passed. He fought and he passed the new act. Whatever it was. And Johnson signed that new immigration policy. He had a big, because they wanted to get political mileage out of this. He had a ceremony at the Statue of Liberty where he signed this new, you know, unrestricted immigration. And that was done in 1965, in October of 1965. Now, Prabhupada arrived September. You don't tell me that Krishna was, I mean, Krishna definitely was in the heart of John F. Kennedy, definitely in the heart of Lyndon Johnson, because he arranged all this whole thing. And actually, you know, Prabhupada had the immigration problem. And, you know, we were trying to get, well, we had a lawyer. We had arranged for a congressman. Through this lawyer was going to arrange a congressman that we were going to pay a bribe. And at that time, to get, well, there was no green card. It was like citizenship, whatever it was. You had to be introduced in Congress by a congressman. So it was a big thing. So we had someone on tap, I won't mention his name, but he was a congressman from New York who was prepared to do this. But it was requiring a huge amount of money. We had nothing. So Prabhupada, and I used to go with Prabhupada to the immigration office. And I would represent myself as a teacher, and you know, I'm an upstanding citizen, and we want this Indian Swami to be an American. So I would go with my hat and my suit and everything. So someone told the Prabhupada that, why don't you go to Canada and apply from Canada? So now, it just so happens, by coincidence, you know, Prabhupada had this one disciple from Montreal, Janice Dunger. He was a French-Canadian, Janardan, he became. And, you know, why, and for, you know, from Montreal, this one, who, he happened to come to New York and he met Prabhupada. And he was a scholar, he was a, you know, big person, he wasn't a hippie here. And he became a devotee, and he went back, and of course, we all opened a center there. So, you know, Montreal, you know, there was New York, there was San Francisco, there was the hippie, but Montreal, what did Montreal have to do with anything? But then, well, there was this center in Montreal, so Prabhupada then went to Montreal, and then he applied. He went to the American Embassy, he applied there, and the officer, Prabhupada showed him his book, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, which has just come out. The man was impressed by the book. There's a whole story of how that book came out, you know, I won't tell it now. But, you know, all coincidental. And so Prabhupada was the first, one of the first cases of applying under the new law. It was like a test case. And of course, they gave it. Immediately, they gave, he had the green card, whatever. So,
this is what year?
68? That was 68, 69. Oh yeah, he was in Canada.
This is after coming back from India.
Yeah, that was in 67.
Yeah. You don't interest me in details, but what happened ultimately in Jhansi? What we love from Jhansi?
Oh, she got that place.
Oh, really?
Well, all right, you want to hear the rest of the story? The rest of the story is, then when Prabhupada went to Bombay, Prabhupada was a huge celebrity. I mean, this is before, you know, with the pandals, you know, 20,000, 30,000 people coming every night. And then Prabhupada was going to all the wealthy people, and they were becoming members and making programs and so on. It was fantastic preaching in Bombay. So then Prabhupada went to the Bhartiya Vidya Bhavan in Bombay. K.M. Munshi, Lalavati Munshi, and, you know, their institution was going down, 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 and they were actually begging Prabhupada to please take our institution, to buy it.
One in Japan.
Yeah. Bhartiya Vidya Bhavan and all of their other things. And their press. They had the press. So, I mean, his is a complete turnaround. that they had taken Prabhupada, and now they're offering Prabhupada. They're begging him, please take this. Specifically the press. And what was Prabhupada's reply? So Prabhupada was, which was very famous, well known in India. Prabhupada said, this is their press is the old style press, you know, the typesetting, you know, with metal type.
Right.
That was old technology. Prabhupada said, in America, I have my book. We set up our press in this ISKCON press in Boston with offset lithograph. You know, everything done by photo plates and so on. So Prabhupada was able to decline that what you're offering to sale is not worth anything. So Prabhupada got them. So it was a whole very interesting. So they were very disappointed and it became nothing.
So basically you mentioned that the life membership program was to facilitate books.
Yes, absolutely.
Prabhupada had also a disciple in Yancey.
Yeah, that was another thing. The Prabhakar Mishra, do you ever meet him? He was, Pukka Sanskritist. He mantras. I mean, he knew the Vedas and this and that. He was a fucking Sanskritist. But he had no interest to work full-time, Prabhupada said. Prabhupada initiated and gave him the name Haridas. So, he had no interest to work full-time. So Prabhupada became so good and he would work just for language kind of thing. Be a pandi kind of thing, but not to work. Prabhupada was to work for Krishna. This is Bhagavad Gita. You work for Krishna. You do this for Krishna. You cook for Krishna. You print books. You sell. You know. You work. So Prabhupada vowed not to initiate anymore. After initiating him, Prabhupada said, "I'm not going to initiate anymore here in Jhansi." So he was the only one. I met him sometimes. When he came to India, we would meet him. You know, he was very had flourished with the hair and chadar thing, you know.
Pandit.
Yeah, real pukka pandit. You know, once or twice he came to see Prabhupada, but he would never do anything to spread Krishna consciousness. So that's in answer to your question.
Do we have time for how the Bhagavad Gita was published?
No, not this time. Hare Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Samalekha Bhakti Vrinda ki jai. If I go to Prabhupada.
Hare Krishna.